Well, hello there. Welcome to Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. I hope you're well. It's great to be back. It's great to be back. It really is. Live from Salford, the world's most listened to independent news radio show. With me, Richie Allen, the BBG. Lots to talk about with you today. Ah, yeah.
Uncensored, unfiltered. You're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, it really is great to be talking with you. It really is. Lovely break, blah, 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 blah. Lovely break. Back to normality now. I've got a great guest for you later on in the programme. I first spoke with her back in 2017. She'd made international headlines for leaving a family court hearing and going into hiding with her two boys. An amazing story. I'm talking about Samantha Baldwin. She's just published her second book. I'll never forget meeting her and her family, her mum and her sister, in Fallowfield in Manchester 7 years ago. Samantha Baldwin will be on the programme a little bit later on at this hour. And when I say you do not want to miss that, I really do mean it. Before that, though, it's the news. It's the news. Yes, good. It's all back to normal. Podcast in the mornings. The live radio show in the afternoon. Thanks for the lovely, kind words. By the way, your comments during the programme to richieallen.co.uk, where it says comment live, or you can download the app for the programme and instantly message the studio. You can do it instantaneously, in a microsecond, in a microsecond, if you like. So your comments, please, during the programme. Donald Trump, the former president of the United States, the would-be next president of the United States, is a bit of a madman, isn't he? He's on trial for election fraud, electoral fraud at the moment. Hush money, it's alleged he paid to Stormy Daniels to keep it out of the press when he was running for president back in 2016. It's farcical. In the court in Manhattan, a judge keeps telling him and his lawyer to shut up. He is mad, Donald Trump, and he is saying some mad stuff today, so he is.
When I'm re-elected, I'll pass a law that bans Richie Allen from ever taking a holiday again.
I mean, that's harsh, that. I don't know if Donald is unaware that he doesn't have any jurisdiction over the UK. He doesn't have any jurisdiction. Did he really say that?
When I'm re-elected, I'll pass a law that bans Richie Allen from ever taking a holiday again.
Well, we'll see. Some nice things were said by people today on hearing I was coming back. This is very nice from Joe. This is lovely from Joe.
My podcast might be hugely popular, but I can only dream of being as good as Richie Allen.
I mean, that's too kind, that. That's very kind. That's artificial intelligence is what that is. Enough messing around, Baldy. Let's get to the real news, because it's important. The Real News, brought to you in association with The Real News. Yeah, war. So you know that the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been in Poland, and you know that he was in Berlin today discussing defence pacts with the Germans. Not football strategies. They're talking about defensive pacts with Germany. Going to put the UK on a war footing, said Sunak. I'll increase defence spending because the Russians are coming, the Iranians are coming, the Houthis are coming, the Chinese are coming. Dark actors are coming for every one of us. For us even. So we've got to throw hundreds of billions of dollars and pounds sterling, presumably, at our puppet masters in the military-industrial complex. It's what we have to do. And while throwing hundreds of billions of pounds away, pissing it down a hole, the whole of the military-industrial complex, at the same time, you've got to lie, or at least grossly exaggerate, the threat posed to the UK by Vlad the Bad, or Vlad the Mad, the Rocket Man in North Korea, and the Ayatollahs. And the Ayatollahs in Iran. The Mullahs. £75 billion new funding that will take the UK's defence budget to 2.5% of national wealth, or by £87 billion a year at the beginning of 2030. Lots of money. Sunak said that £10 billion would be used to, quote, put the UK's own defence industry on a war footing, end quote. We need to be ready for war. and he said hugely ramp up domestic weapons production. Again, that's a direct quote. Always money for war, and when all else fails, they take you to war, as the great Gerald Celente often says. Now, we'll have some reaction. You remember Ben Wallace, a former UK Defence Secretary? He's a tad less boring than Grant Shapps, the current Defence Secretary, which might explain why Wallace was sent out to deal with the media this morning. Here he is with Kay Burley talking all things war footing. You'll hear Kay first.
Who's the biggest threat? Which country?
Right now, the biggest direct threat to the United Kingdom will be Russia. Russia is already active against us. We saw it in Salisbury.
Salisbury. Holy Mother of Jesus. Salisbury was what? How many years ago was it now? That crazy Novichok story, which nobody believed. Not even in this country. So Salisbury, right? The Russian Salisbury.
We've seen it in numerous cyber attacks. We see it in cyber crime. Many of the big cyber crime syndicates in the world are based in Russia.
Any evidence?
Curiously protected by the Russian state. And
any evidence of that?
They're the ones robbing your granny and my parents with phishing emails and things like that.
So they're robbing your grannies, the Russians, or at least cyber criminals hiding out in Russia, protected by Vlad the Mad, are sending out phishing schemes which are catching your granny right out, and she's losing, well, her nest egg and your inheritance. It's all about granny. Granny, okay.
So Russia is a directly challenges us at all levels, and of course...
I mean, if you were Kay, you'd jump in and you'd say, really? Massively increase our defence spending, Ben, because there's a few cyber criminals in Russia putting out some phishing scams to catch granny. Is that all, Ben?
Of course, what it is doing in Ukraine is a direct threat to us and the wider Europe.
But there's no evidence of this either, that what Russia is doing in Ukraine. And you know, listen, if you happen to be listening to the programme for the first time, and there's always somebody listening for the first time, I despise Vladimir Putin just as much as I despise Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Corbyn, David Cameron, any of them. Detest the man, because he's another puppet in my opinion. But this is weak stuff, this, isn't it, by Ben Wallace, justifying why we need to spend so much money on the military.
That's number one. Terrorism hasn't gone away. Whatever your position is on Gaza, the recruiting sergeants of terrorists and the radicalizers will be using Gaza to spread in my constituency and all over the United Kingdom.
What does he mean by that? The recruiting sergeants for terrorism will be using Gaza to recruit people in my neighborhood and in your neighborhood. If this sounds familiar, dear listener, it's because it feckin' well should feel familiar. They've been drying out that horse manure for decades now. Sleeper cells. And what's going on in Gaza, what he means by going on in Gaza, of course, is the wanton slaughter of tens of thousands of innocent men, women and children. That's what he means. And he says this might outrage people in this country to become radicalised. So we need to be prepared. So it's not just international threats like the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians. It's also domestic terrorists. This is all fear-mongering old bollocks, this, isn't it?
Fear and division.
Stoked by you, dickhead, and your government.
And we see that on our streets. So terrorism, I'm afraid, is growing in some parts of the world. In Africa, it's growing. So that hasn't gone away. And obviously, we see Iran and the Houthis. You know, we've had British ships with missiles fired at it pretty recently. And,
wow.
And that's the challenge.
Anything coming back at all from RK?
I thought you were going to say China.
Rather than dive right in with 2 feet and say to Wallace, pull the other one, you lamentable, pathetic puppet of a man. Kay says, I asked you, who's the biggest threat? I thought you'd say China. I got China in the office sweepstakes, Ben, but you said Russia.
Rise of China is growing. China right now threatens the United Kingdom insofar as...
How?
Challenging international rule of law. Freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, what it's been doing in Hong Kong, human rights challenges. And the reason I used to say that by 2030, there's going to be either a cold or a warm war.
Yeah, by 2030, there'll be a cold or a warm war somewhere. Kay has been around the block a few times. You would have thought to understand what a hot war is.
Somewhere that will affect us. We should prepare.
What does that mean, a warm war?
An actual hot conflict.
Okay.
I mean, going to war.
Got it.
Maybe not Britain, but it will affect us. because both China and the United States planning timelines for some...
I can't remember which of Morecambe and Wise was the straight person, the straight man. I can't remember. But Kay Burley is effectively just doing this. He's... What is vomiting out of Ben Wallace's mouth is pure comedy. And rather than eviscerate him, Burley is basically acting as the straight man, asking for answers to questions she already understands. I mean, she knows what a hot war is, a warm war. She's been around, hanging around Sky News now for about 77 years. Right, so she's just a straight woman for Wallace, lobbing up these little tennis balls for him to smash down. It's massive, massive propaganda. That's all you're getting on mainstream media today. You know, no questions, none whatsoever. I mean, at the very least, say to Burley, or Burley could say to Wallace, why spend all of this money instead of just getting Putin and, I don't know, the current president of Iran and maybe the current president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, and get them all. I tell you what, why don't you go on a proper piss up for a couple of weeks and settle it all between you, and the rest of us then can get on with the rest of our lives. But at no point does Burley, and neither did any other mainstream journalist today, ask any of these goons like Wallace, why aren't you sorting this shit out around tables to say, what is your grievance? But what is your problem with us, if you have one? What is it that we're doing that you don't like? And maybe we can reach some kind of entente cordiale, as it were. But nobody's asking this question. It's all propaganda. Why do we need all of these weapons, Ben? Because cyber criminals in Russia are coming after granny savings.
Some form of friction or conflict when China's military forces are ready and scale is towards the end of the decade.
Wow. So I think it's going to happen around 2030 because the Chinese will be ready, says Ben Wallace. By the way, my opinion, my theory, that every single government in the world, everyone without exception, is somehow controlled by the architects of the overarching agenda. And most people don't agree with me, and that's fair enough. If I'm right, we're in serious shit, really, aren't we? Because ultimately, if I'm right, we will have a war by the end of the decade, and it could be massive, and it could be the catalyst for the introduction of all manner of restrictions on the things we can and can't do, and certainly the introduction of a central bank digital currency, maybe, because any major war will, of course, collapse many of the major economies, you would have imagined. In any case, it's coming up for 13 minutes past the hour. Like I said, every channel is covering this today. Let's hear a couple of journalists, allegedly, we use the term very loosely on the Richie Allen Show. Here's Grace Blakely. She's a journalist and author, and she's sitting alongside Freddie Sayers. He's the editor-in-chief at Unheard. They were on Politics Live, a panel programme on the BBC today. This'll make you laugh. It sounds good for a minute. Blakely says, Grace says, don't spend it on guns. Don't spend it on... This is good. It sounds really good. And then she says...
Look, it would have been better to spend that money from a national security perspective on things like investing in decarbonisation. And this is not just something coming from a kind of lefty-lovey snowflake. This is a point that has been made by the Ministry of Defence, by generals in the US, that climate breakdown is one of the single biggest threats.
Climate breakdown is one of the biggest single threats. So don't spend the money on weapons and guns. Let's spend the money on the war against climate change, says Grace Blakely. God save us.
To our security as individual nations and as a world. That's not even mentioning the fact that Putin is literally being funded from revenues from fossil fuels, not to mention other countries that we treat as allies, like Saudi Arabia, which is an incredibly autocratic regime, and which, you know, is sold weapons and is funded through oil revenue. So if we want to move to a safer world, one that is free of autocratic dictators funded by fossil fuels, and one in which we're prepared for what will inevitably be a massive change refugee flows and all those sorts of things because of climate breakdown.
Climate breakdown is going to change, to exacerbate, to make worse refugee flows around the world. So if we deal with the fossil fuel issue, that will serve two purposes. One will defeat climate change, we'll win that war, and also will make it more difficult for Vladimir Putin to arm himself because he depends so much on the revenue from oil and gas. Freddie Sayers is putting in from Unheard.
Bursaries are funded through fossil fuels. How does it make us safer to abandon them?
What I'm saying is that if we want to build a safer world, it's not enough simply to respond to threats as they arise. We have to actually invest in creating that safer world. And what I was saying was that if we had invested that money in decarbonisation a long time ago, Putin would have been a lot weaker when this war started.
We need to put the number into context. 2.5% brings us back to 2010. Mm. It was over 5% in the 1980s. So it makes the front pages and it seems like a lot. But my suspicion is it's just the beginning, because once the reality of the next American presidential administration starts to kick home, Europe needs to work out how to defend itself. And I don't think we've even begun to realise the cost and the hard choices that is going to entail.
Not a single person on any panel show today, and do believe me, I've watched them all, not one saying, is this insane or what? In this time of great austerity, of great poverty, in this manufactured cost of living crisis, isn't it mental to be committing tens and then hundreds of billions of pounds to defend ourselves against who? Against which enemies? What enemies? Nobody challenging, nobody questioning, I suppose you're not surprised. And just to double down on that point for a moment, not a single one, by the way, not a single comment, I can't actually believe it, said it's a bad idea to get back into an arms race. You know, like we tried it in the 50s and 60s, like the military-industrial complex made trillions of dollars. Nobody's arguing against it. Blakely said spend it on another war, the war against climate breakdown. Now, it's worse in politics. Do you think there's any opposition to it politically? Think again. The Labour Party, most likely to form the next government. Let's have a listen to LBC Radio. Giles Kenningham is a former Conservative Party communications director. He is in conversation on LBC with Darren Jones from the Labour Party. And Darren Jones very quickly rushes to assure the listeners of LBC Radio that Labour will commit to the same spending promises made by Sunak on the military.
There is not a dividing line between Labour and the Conservatives on defence spending.
There is not a dividing line between Labour and the Conservatives on defence spending. Let's hear him again.
There is not a dividing line between Labour and the Conservatives on defence spending.
Now let's hear the former Tory communications director, Giles Kenningham.
Well, I mean, there is, in the sense that obviously you guys are hoping to match this commitment, but you aren't. It's a qualified kind of matching of sorts.
We both agree we want to get to 2.5% of GDP.
We want to get to 2.5% of GDP, gross domestic product. So, no opposition from His Majesty's opposition party. Is it heading? Maybe it is, Gerald Celente. When all else fails, they take you to war. Your comments in a moment, and then we'll talk about something completely different. Music first. I can't wait to catch up later on in this hour with Samantha Baldwin, an amazing woman I first met back around about now in 2017. Around about now. Okay, music then. Yes, thank you to every one of you for sending a welcome back message. I won't read them all. Thank you. You're too kind. Hi to Ian Robert Horton. Hi, Ian. Richie, when is the world going to take action against Israel after the mass graves? There are a couple of cases pending at the ICC, Ian. I don't know, mate. To be honest, I don't want to be depressing you on my first day back after my break, but I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for Israel to be held accountable for what it has done in Gaza, which is genocide and the most disgusting crimes against humanity. But look, I say this, and I know is that when I say this, it annoys some. Because when I say this, you think I'm kind of pandering to Israel, which is ridiculous. Right? But when we talk about these egregious, these outlandish, these purely evil crimes against people, look at what the United States, the United Kingdom, to name two countries, has done around the world in only the last 30 years. Right? I'll leave that one hanging there. Hi to Mark. Hi to the sarcastic window cleaner. Hi to Pandora. Yeah, I loved my time down there in Torquay, so I did. And we had wonderful weather for the duration of the holiday. Hi to Neil, who says Grace Blakely hasn't quite realised yet that she and everybody else is the carbon they want to eliminate. That's Neil. Thank you, Neil. Hi to Kay, who says Ernie Wise was the straight man Richie. Eric Morecambe was the funny one. Our politicians are comedians, says Kay, laughing. in our faces, all of them. It's about time we turned our backs on them. Amen to this. Amen to that. Hi to Julie. I agree. It's all about controlling the masses and the money. There's no doubt about it. The countries mentioned by Sunak yesterday, today, by Ben Wallace, those are countries with, in some cases, hundreds of millions, and in the case of China, more than a billion people living in them. The idea that these people represent, or that they manifest as some sort of enemy of yours and of mine, is patently absurd. It is, we know this to be true, regardless of the colour of your skin or the god you worship. Most of us, 99.99999999999% of people, are peace-loving, law-abiding, loving, honest, decent, neighbourly people. That's right across planet Earth. And we just want to be left the fuck alone. Apologies for the language. And this is the thing, I wonder, will it ever dawn on people? When they're listening to lawyers like Wallace and his mates this morning talking about threats and our enemies, does it occur to people as they're driving to work, what is he talking about? What enemies is he talking about? And is that the best he can do, really? Talk about cyber crimes and granny? Give me a break. Give me a break. Hi to Gail. Hi, Gail. Wise was a straight man, she says. Thank you to everybody who put me right there. Lewis says the Zionist-controlled media, he says, has been in overdrive recently. The staged event in London with Mr. Anti-Semitism himself saying that 90% of Jewish people now are scared to go out, says Lewis. Of course, the many people who are Jewish, who do march for Palestine, don't share his views. Lewis is referring to a guy that I know very well, a guy called Gideon Falter, who was one of the leaders, or the ringleaders, Gideon Falter, about 4-5 years ago in trying to get the Richie Allen show cancelled. Falter is nothing if he isn't stupid, you know, the campaign against anti-Semitism. They told anybody who would listen that nobody should come on the Richie Allen show. And then farcically, somebody connected with them came up to Portland Street in Manchester and knocked on the door of Fab Radio Studios in Portland Street and asked them to discontinue their association with the Richie Allen Show. And the wonderful Mike threatened to go and get a shotgun. And they ran away from... Yeah, Falter is an absolute scumbag. The campaign against anti-Semitism isn't a charity, even though it was awarded charitable status. It is a Zionist attack dog that exists to do one thing and one thing only, and that is, of course, to go after any criticism of Israel, particularly if the criticism is coming from an amplified source. In other words, if you have a little bit of an audience and you're criticising Israel, they'll come after you. The time is 25 minutes past the hour of 4. A very good evening to Patricia. Good evening, Patricia, and thank you very much for your lovely words. Mike says, Richie, Biden gave Iran $300 million for a fireworks show to sell Europeans Iron Dome systems, says Mike. Thank you, Mike. Hi to Brian, who says, you despise Putin because he's a puppet and not because he's a tyrant. But if he's a tyrant, Brian, it doesn't make him any different than Rishi Sunak, than Boris Johnson, does it? Than Leo Varadkar, Simon Harris. And ultimately, I don't think you've listened to me. I believe that Putin is as controlled, is as controlled, is as under duress as the politicians that are more familiar with us here in the UK and in Ireland. That is my opinion. Feel free to disagree with it. It is my opinion. Now, let's get away from Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, and war. We'll stay with politics briefly. It's always nice to have a giggle. LBC Radio again had a London. It had a mayoral election debate yesterday. So they invited Sadiq Khan, the current mayor of London, and one or two of his opponents into the studio to debate policy and whatnot ahead of the election, which is only a few weeks away now. The presenter of the programme was incredulous at a policy, a Green Party policy, explained by Zoe Garbutt. Now, Zoe Garbutt is the Green Party's candidate in the London mayoral election. This did make me laugh. Talk about lofty ambitions. Have a listen.
You've suggested that you would like to see no murders in London in 10 years.
What? What? She suggested she'd like to see what in 10 years?
You've suggested that you would like to see no murders in London in 10 years.
That's a policy. That is a policy and a half. Yes, if you elect me as mayor of London, I will see to it that in 10 years there will be no murders in London.
Yeah, that's fantasy land. That's not going
to
happen.
I think we have
to... It's terrible, but there's nowhere else in the world.
We have to absolutely set what our ambitions are, and I think any higher than... Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to... Because then all of our strategies and all of our policies aim towards that. I've worked in the NHS, and we have targets and policies working towards addressing mass inequalities. And I think if you don't set a bold target, you're not going to take the action to get there.
Wonderful. Set a bold target that you'll never reach. But you might get close to it. I don't know how many murders take place in London every year. Not because I'm lazy. I could have looked it up earlier, but I didn't. I should have looked it up. How many murders do you think are committed in London per annum, do you think? I'm going to have a wild stab at it, no pun intended. I'm going to say 84. There you are, there's a number. 84. Now, while we're trying to... While you go looking for the real number, you scallywags, let's talk about ID cards. Yes, Tony Blair loves an ID card, doesn't he? Tried to get them in when he was Prime Minister. And so did his predecessor, Gordon, what's his face? Gordon Brown, the man who makes the strange face every time he finishes a sentence. David Blunkett used to be the Home Secretary when Blair was Prime Minister. But he was for a time anyway. He's blind. I'm saying this not to mock him, of course not, but so that you'll get a picture of him. Lord Blunkett he is now. He sits in the House of Lords. That's the reward they give you. When you're a lick spittle, when you're a boot lick, for the New World Order agenda, and you bend over and take it up the backside, and you do what they tell you to do, they give you a cushy little number in the House of Lords where you get paid £300 a day to snore and to fart your way through the afternoons, because they have a bar up there in the House of Lords which is heavily subsidised. So they whisky the living bejesus out of themselves, old feckers like David Blunkett, and they sleep their way through their afternoons, and as they're leaving, they pick up a cheque for £300 sterling. Thank you very much. I'm sure they don't get paid daily. I'm sure it's weekly or monthly, but you get the picture. Anyway, Blunkett wants to bring back ID cards. He reckons by doing so, you will tackle the small boats crisis. Horrible story. You've probably seen it today. A boat capsized in the channel yesterday, packed with people. Absolutely packed, and a young 7-year-old girl was one of the dead. I like you because I think you're a human being. Because while on the one hand you know that this immigration agenda is designed to divide people, to make people hate one another, so that we'll fight one another, so that they'll take their great reset agenda, thank you very much, and proceed with it while we're too busy killing each other in the culture wars. While you know this, you are a human being. And these are real people. And that was a real girl who died in the channel yesterday. Right, okay. So they brought it back to Politics Live on the BBC. Because of what happened yesterday, they said, let's get David Blunkett on and ask him to tell us why. Tell us, David, how an ID card scheme, presumably one which would be on your smart devices, your smartphone, how would this stop the boats, David Blunkett, please?
Because we would avoid what everybody understands as modern slavery. What's going to happen, regrettably, in the period before this is sorted out, is that people are going to be told by the smugglers, by the traffickers, that they just get to the coast and they'll give them a telephone number, and when they ring it, they'll be promised somewhere to sleep and a job, and they'll disappear into the sub-economy. And the only way we can deal with that is if we have a proper identity system, which incidentally would also avoid the massive increase in identity fraud. With modern technology, people would have it on their smartphone. We'd link it to the passport, so you gave no more information than you give for your passport. And in the end, I think people would just accept that this is the only way forward. We give...
People would accept that this is the only way forward.
Give more information to the private sector than we've ever given in our history, and people don't blink. Why not have a system that would actually deal with the traffickers and the organised criminals and those capturing people? Because that's what they're going to be doing. In fact, that's what they're doing already.
Right. Rather than I argue against what Blunkett said. Let's listen to Miriam Cates from the Tories. Miriam Cates MP. She was on the same panel, sitting next to Blunkett.
When people ridicule those who fear state overreach, I get very worried, because we know from what happened in COVID, not just here but around the world, that actually there is a temptation for the states to overreach whenever that facility is there. And I think the difference between us giving away our data to the likes of Amazon and Google, which I'm equally nervous
about,
they do, and I think the government should do much more to regulate those companies, but there is a difference between that and the government having everybody's details on some single central register that then could be in the future used for malign purposes. And I think it's already illegal to work here if you don't have the right status. The Home Office already takes biometric data from everybody who arrives here illegally and everybody who claims a visa legally. So it is absolutely possible for immigration enforcement to turn up at an employer and find out whether those people have the right status to work. And if they don't, the employer is fined £45,000.
But do they?
Are
there that many cases of that happening? So the Home Office complain endlessly that it is because that isn't enforced.
So the Home Office have massively stepped up enforcement. Last year there was a 68% increase.
Yeah, I think it was from 10 to 18.
But it's heading in the right direction. But the point is, even if you introduce identity cards, if you are determined to slip into the black market, what difference would this make? Whether
David,
or not you've got an identity
card?
Well,
let David defend the policy and I'll come back to you, Freddie.
Let David defend the policy.
Simply, when you're accessing any free service or you're actually presenting your identity as to whom you are, you need to be able to do that with some evidence. And all I'm suggesting is that that would be a good way of having
but
the evidence.
But we already do that. We need a national insurance number or an NHS number for those purposes.
Ask the question about Tony Blair's involvement in all this. A lot of this is being pushed by the Tony Blair Institute, a vast organisation with...
This is Freddie Sayers again, the editor-in-chief of Unheard. Very good here, Freddie. Even though earlier on he was all for the defence spending. Here he talks about what the Tony Blair Foundation is.
Pushed by the Tony Blair Institute, a vast organisation with 800 plus employees, $100 million of revenue.
$100 million in revenue. Blair's Institute.
And, when you read their policies, it connects ID cards with health passports, with ideas for banking and currency centralisation. And it's not conspiratorial or out there to worry that if you walk around with a single government ID that has every step you do attached to it, that is a serious change in our freedom.
It's very interesting to be on a programme with three of you who in very different ways from far left to far right.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. When confronted with reality, Blunkett resorts to calling them far left and far right.
Are libertarians.
Well,
and value
their freedom.
Well, of course.
They did well not to get annoyed and just to laugh at them.
But you were a libertarian during COVID, and we spoke about lockdowns.
We live in a free society. If we didn't live in a free society because we'd voted in a fascist government, then, of course, it would be irrelevant whether we had this information or not, because they would impose it.
Yeah, this government and it's the previous government and the one before that, strikingly resembling, for me in any case, fascism or fascistic. Things are getting darker, aren't they? Interesting exchange that. Well done to Sayers for talking about Blair's intention to marry the ID card with the health passport and the vaccine passport and the central bank digital currencies. You don't often hear stuff like that discussed on the BBC. There's a time right now, would you believe it? It's 24 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. You are listening to your Richie Allen Show. It's an absolute pleasure to be back with you.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support the Richie Allen Show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Fantastic, yeah, fantastic. Fan dabby dozy, I say.
When I'm re-elected, I'll pass a law that bans Richie Allen from ever taking a holiday again.
Yeah, we'll have to see about that. Right, where am I going now? Back to your comments. Don't forget, Samantha Baldwin will be on the programme shortly. Let me just do something here, hang on. I thought I'd done all of this yesterday. All of this tweaking and stuff. Two. Do you ever see a band like that? Do you ever go to a pub to watch a band? And you felt like bottling the lead singer before the actual gig starts, carrying on with all of that shit. Two, 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 one, two, 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 and all of that shite. Sorry to put you through that. Let me do that again. Wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. Come here and I tell you, the Papers podcast is back. It'll be online. It will be online at the very latest at 7:30 UK time. That's Monday to Friday, 7:30 at the latest. I plan on recording it at 7. It'll be finished about 25 past and then getting it online instantaneously. So that's the Papers podcast, which is back now. Hello to Rob in Birmingham. Hello, Rob. Thank you for your message. I really appreciate it. David is in Blackpool and he says, Richie, you probably don't care and think it's irrelevant. I don't think it's irrelevant, David. He says, do you think Trump will be the next president? Even Gerald Celente couldn't predict the election, or said he couldn't when he was asked, or whether Biden might get back in. Unusual for Celente to be stumped for words with a prediction. It is unusual for Gerald. I suppose Gerald probably thinks, as I think, that ultimately it doesn't really matter whether it's Biden or Trump, really, because the agenda will rumble on, won't it? At least that's how I see it. Thanks to Paul in Scotland for the link. Thank you, Paul. I'll get on to that, my friend. And Kay had a look. Well done, Kay. I said 84 murders in London. I was quite a way out. Last year, 2022 to 2023, there were 112 murders in London. That's an awful lot, isn't it? In a society where gun ownership, while it isn't illegal, it's very, very difficult to own a gun. And we are not culturally predisposed, are we, in the UK to owning firearms, much to the bemusement of many of our cousins in America. I have no time for guns myself. But in a society, I know knives kill people too. I'm not stupid, you know. 112, thanks for the research, Kay. So she's not got too much then, too far to go, has she, the Green Party woman, to get London down to zero murders within a decade. Another David says, then he says they would have to issue a government smartphone, but it is a tiptoe to a chip in the hand, says David. So David reckons that your ID card on your phone and your vaccine passport and your health passport, all of this is ultimately a stepping stone to us carrying a chip under our skin. Do you remember years ago, employees of a company somewhere in America, I can't remember which city it was, but employees were offered the chance, if they felt like it, if they were up for it, as we say, to take part in a trial where they would have a chip underneath the skin on the back of their hand, and they would use it to access the vending machine. Do you remember this? I can't remember exactly where it happened in the States, but they had no shortage of volunteers, people coming forward to say, yeah, I'll have a go. Yeah, stick a chip in me, man. Mad stuff. Hi to Dario. Hello, Dario. Richie, a lot of shite has been happening since the last show. He says, I'm glad you're back and you had good holidays. Thank you, Dario. Yes, a lot has gone down. But things are moving pretty quickly now, I think we would agree. It's Wednesday's Richie Allen Show. With me, Richie Allen, coming up for 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Wonderful song from Sierra Ferrell. This is Far Away Across the Sea. Far Away Across the Sea. Right, 22 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Wednesday's programme, that was Sierra Ferrell and Far Away Across the Sea. The Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from Salford in the heart of Greater Manchester. Now, before I welcome Samantha back to this programme, it's been quite a while since we chatted, I'm going to do a quick summary of who Samantha, not who she is, but of what has happened to her in the last seven and a half years. Well, longer, really. It goes back further than that. So let me do that. I met Samantha around about this time 7 years ago, back in 2017, in Fallowfield in Manchester. She'd sent a message to me. I think maybe she heard me speak with a lovely woman called Vicky Haig and reached out to me, I think. And I met her in Fallowfield and her mum and her sister. And I was blown away by what I heard. And we're going to talk all about this. Let me tell you how I understand things. Samantha Baldwin. Sam split with her husband shortly after the birth of their second child. They had two boys, and one of the boys told Samantha that his father had been abusing him when he was with his father after the separation. Now, his younger brother also told Sam that he had been abused by his dad and his paternal grandfather. Now, she was apoplectic. She couldn't believe it, went to the police, and based on the boy's evidence, their father, her ex-husband, was arrested. He denied it in a police interview. Now, the officer who interviewed him came back to Samantha and said he, the officer, didn't believe that her ex-husband had abused his sons. He said something rather amazing. He said, "It doesn't look like a paedophile's house," he said. Now, the boy's disclosures were graphic, but they became more graphic. The accounts were horrific of abuse and rape at the hands of their father, grandparents and other parties. And the boys told Sam that their dad had threatened them that if they told her, they would never see her again. The police amazingly, and I mean this, and maybe I shouldn't editorialise here, but I still can't believe this, but it is true, they didn't at that time arrange for a physical examination of the boys. No offer of a medical investigation. So Samantha went to her GP, told the GP about the disclosures made by the boys, and said that the boys needed to be examined. Before she knew it, there was a knock on her front door, because the doctor, who Sam had confided in confidence, had spoken to in confidence, had called social services and the police. They turned up. The older boy told the same story to the police and the social services. The stories were consistent. Two men were arrested. None of them were Samantha's ex-husband. Two men were arrested, right? So the boys were booked in for an examination at a sexual health clinic. Samantha asked for hair samples to be taken, as the boys had discussed being injected, suggesting that maybe they had been drugged. Now, they did go to be examined at a sexual health clinic. And the older boy was re-interviewed and repeated the claims he had made all along and made fresh claims, saying that more people were involved. So Samantha took the lads to Nottinghamshire to get them away from danger, because some of the people named by the boys were living in the area where Sam was living at that time. Now, she was contacted by Greater Manchester Police. They said there were no further investigations planned and that they wouldn't be charging her ex-husband or anybody. And amazingly, Samantha was ordered to appear before a family court, where she was accused of fabricating it and emotionally abusing her own children. Now, when it became obvious to Sam that the judge was going to rule against her in favour of her ex-husband, the boy's father, she absconded with the boys, and this was given international media coverage. We discussed it on this programme at the time. It was absolute blanket coverage from the press, from the print media and the broadcasters. She was eventually discovered and was hauled back into family court and was basically accused of drugging her own children and falsely making allegations of, or making false allegations of sexual abuse against their dad. So she was accused of making it up. But again, incredibly, the judge sitting, hearing the case, a guy called Jeremy Lee, he said that although Sam genuinely believed the boys had been sexually abused, the allegations themselves were false, he said at the time. He said in his judgment he found the father hadn't perpetrated the abuse against the boys alleged by the mum, and that the allegations made by Samantha Baldwin were false. There's so much to this, right? Sam and her family went and took a lie detector test by a firm that's very well known for conducting lie detector tests, and they passed the tests with flying colours. There's a lot more to it. She's written two books about it. The first one was called Everything Is Going to Be Okay, and she's just published a follow-up to that book. It's called Pretended Justice, and it's a pleasure to welcome back to the programme Samantha Baldwin. Sam, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine, Richie. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on the book. I really do mean that. Before we talk about it, I know I omitted an awful lot of information in that summing up, but if I was to carry on with it, I'd be going till 6 or 7 o'clock and we wouldn't hear a word from you. I'll never forget meeting you and your sister and your mum in Fallowfield. It was around about, if not this time, it might have been a bit later in 2017. It was after the boys had been taken into care. I think they later were given, the father was given custody. And life was insane for you then. It doesn't sound to me that much has changed for you since we first met and spoke, in terms of your campaign for justice is as relentless now as it was back then. Is that fair to say?
It is, Richie, yeah. And actually, at that time, it became even worse, if people can believe that, but it actually became even worse later on of that year, 2017. But at that time, I was still in court, and as you said, the boys had been temporarily placed in foster care, and then later on that year, they were moved into the care of their father. And that's what family court do now. I found out since that's what they do in all these cases. They have it all set out.
Tell us. Sorry, Sam. Tell us about that. Right, we've got till 6 o'clock, so we've got loads of time. Yeah. Because one of the things you did was obviously investigate this whole kind of phenomenon where somebody makes an accusation against an ex-husband or an ex-wife, and the person who makes the allegation, often with supporting evidence from the child, ends up losing access to their own child. How widespread is this, as far as you understand it?
I think it's even more widespread than any of us can imagine, and it's not rare. And obviously with the courts being held in secret, it was only because I ran, that's why mine got public attention. But there has been studies done on this, albeit in America. However, our courts are in exactly the same way they do in America. And a 10-year study was carried out by Professor Jo Meyer. And at the end of this study, she concluded that only 15% of the time child sex abuse is accepted by the court. And when that includes, when you get child sex abuse and child physical abuse, that's only accepted 13% of the time. So when your sons are disclosing about multiple people and all sorts of things and injections, you've got no chance whatsoever of keeping hold of your children, whether you're a mother or a father, by the way.
15%.
Yeah, and then if the other parent then uses what's called parental alienation, which is just a made-up quack term by a man in America who's since committed suicide, who had some extremely questionable beliefs about sexual deviancy and things like that, to do with animals and children. And his idea of a good mother would be, if a child reported abuse to her, then you should say, "Don't talk about your father like that or I'll beat you." And that is how the family court work. And if you try and protect your child, then you're seen as an absolute danger. But yeah, I'm just reading the back of my book now, because I actually talk about that particular study in the back of my new book. And only 2% of child sex abuse cases are credited when the other parent, the dangerous parent, claims parental alienation against the protective parent. So that shows how
it sounds like a very effective defense then. So I imagine when a parent is accused of abusing their own children and they are separated from the other parent, it sounds like, well, I imagine lawyers, solicitors are saying to people, play that parental alienation card. But what I want to put to you is, in our first conversations, we did a couple of interviews. So the first time Sam and I spoke, I grilled Sam I properly grilled her on all these points, and I gave you a proper chasing, and you were brilliant and you stood up to it. And we had a really good conversation. Obviously, I'm not going to do that today. I want to talk about the book, and I want to talk about the boys as best as you can, and what's happening, and what the future might look like for you. But that parental alienation thing, While those statistics you've given me are absolutely right, because I've looked them up myself, and I do think there's something very, very wrong with those stats, it can't be the case that every time, or nearly every time, a parent makes such a serious allegation of sexual abuse, that they're only doing it to spite or to kind of to really hurt their former partner and to exclude them from the children's lives. It just can't be. But it must be the case sometimes, Sam. Some relationships, I suppose, might become so toxic, as in a couple, it might be so horrible, the breakup, that it's feasible to me that maybe there are some instances where it might be the case. I mean, have you come across any where it was a legitimate thing, where the person did invent it because of their absolute hatred for their former partner?
No, I think you're exactly right, Richard. Now, there are people like that who make things up for whatever reason, maybe, you know, mental illness or just vengeance, who knows? But, you know, I wouldn't know of any cases that where the court have turned out to get it right, because how could we know, really? Yeah. Do you know, there's no kind of... We wouldn't necessarily get to find out about those cases, because how would you, you know? But yeah, I think we see enough from the criminal courts to know that people have been prosecuted for actually making false claims. So of course they exist. But in actual fact, it's probably more like the opposite way around as to how the courts are determining it at the moment. They're saying we're all like that. You know, 90%, 95% of us, in reality, it's probably more like the 5%, you know, who would do that kind of thing.
There must be, should be an immediate inquiry into that. I mean, that deserves investigation. How could they possibly, with a straight face, say that 9 out of 10 parents who claim that their children have been sexually abused are doing it to alienate the other parent? I mean, that is just farcical. And worthy of some sort of judicial inquiry, I would have said. And I mean, in your case, and I am not here to say that what you told me 7 years ago is true. It's not for me to say that at all. I would, having not heard any of the case, because of course journalists and the press in general are completely banned from the family court system. It's illegal to report on the ongoings in the courts. But I've lost the train of my thought there. I was going to ask you about, there's got to be a judicial inquiry into that. But in your cases, it's not for me to say whether what you claim happened is right or wrong. The listeners will make their own minds up. But there's such incredible detail in your own case in terms of what the boys said, the consistency of what they said, the medical evidence that you were able to obtain, the lie detector tests. I mean, You brought an avalanche of information to me, didn't you? And not just to me, to absolutely. Other broadcasters. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, when you are telling the truth, you appreciate a challenging interview like the one you gave me, you know, a few years ago. That's very much appreciated, because then you can actually prove your innocence. Well, not prove it, but you can actually, you know, you can answer every single question that's fired at you because you're telling the truth. And so, you know, contrasted with somebody who isn't telling the truth will just hide. You know, if I'd have been, just to give you an example, if I'd have been accused of being a paedophile, for example, I would, even if I'd have won custody in the court, I would be out there putting it out publicly, you know, lie detector tests and proving my innocence, because what an awful thing to be accused of if you weren't, you know. Similarly, I've been accused of horrendous stuff, so that is what I do. I continue to, you know, prove my innocence and do everything I can to expose the court and also, and not to just expose my situation, but also to be a voice to warn others as well, because it's so well hidden that we, you know, the public don't know what goes on behind those doors. And as a consequence, you then go into court thinking naively, going into it blindly, that you know you're going to get justice and that your children will be protected, you know, not thinking of in a million years that they will turn it all around, ignore every evidence, and that the balance of probabilities that should be there to protect children, that of proving something to a 51% likelihood of chance of happening, is actually extremely dangerous.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Samantha Baldwin is our guest, right? I'll put links. You know this. Sam has published two books. The most recent one, it's out now, Pretended Justice. Go to samanthabaldwin.co.uk for all the information. I'll put a link to where you can buy the book. It's the sequel to Everything is Going to Be Okay. Sam's case is one of the most infamous cases, I think, ever when it comes to how the family courts in this country operate. So let's talk then. Let's talk, you and me. Let's talk about a hypothetical situation. You are campaigning to raise awareness and to warn people. So my other half may very well be listening to this now. We don't have any children, sadly. But if we did have, and if we split up, and she genuinely suspected, Caroline is my missus' name, if she suspected that I was sexually abusing our child, what should she do, Sam?
Leave the country, Richie. It's as simple as that. And she should research which countries do not have an extradition, you know, any extradition laws with the UK. North Cyprus is one, and there are some others like China and Thailand. And there's some other dangerous countries that you probably would be best off not going to. But I would, unfortunately, that is my advice.
You don't think she'd stand a chance in the UK court system that if I had done something as heinous as that, and there was evidence to support it, you're saying that the odds are against her, even with evidence? I know this sounds pathetic because this has happened to you, right? But I'm labouring this point because it's your contention that your own case, as crazy as it is not an isolated one, that it's a fairly common one. So get out as quick as you possibly can. Tell as few people as you possibly can. Pack your bags and get the hell out. Don't trust the law. Don't go to the police.
Yeah, and it's a sad state of affairs, and that's the only advice you can give. But again, you'd either face, you know, you could either or not disclose it and just, you know, send the child to an abusive father to be abused every week. Those are your options. Unfortunately, that, you know, these child abusers seem to know all about family court, so they would take them to family court. And the more you fight there, the more they cannot stand a protective parent who actually fights for the children, who believes them, who never like doubts them or anything. And, you know, they just put abusers on pedestals. They really do.
How did they do that? How do you mean they put abusers on pedestals?
Well, they just seem to. I'm not talking about every single case, you know, like say, so, you know, the family court are there to, should just be there to deal with divorces and finances, but they're not. They're involved in all kinds of things that shouldn't be involved in. But it's from meeting different parents, so this is men and women, mainly women, but I do know a couple of men, a few men actually, who've been accused of things, and I really don't believe they have done. And there's some other men as well who've it's been the other way around, apart from the child has disclosed about, say, a maternal grandparent or something. And so I know men have been accused of parental alienation. And similarly, the court will quite often just side with the abuser, whether that is somebody who's, you know, malicious towards their ex, or somebody like me who was just trying to protect the children. I cannot conclude anything more. So unfortunately, when people talk about, let's get more training, you know, the petitioning for more training for the judges, like I saw something, what's that ex-Spice Girl called? Scary, I don't know what her real name is, but she was called Scary Spice in the Spice Girls. There's something to do with coercive control, and she's asking for more training for the judges. And I just think, seriously, do you think it's like a training issue? These judges who were paid massive salaries, you think they're not trained? It's like I doubt it very much. This stuff's been going on for decades.
Melanie Brown, yeah, from the Spice Girls. Because this is a really interesting point now that you're bringing up. You're listening to Samantha Baldwin. So money certainly plays a part in this. It was speaking with you 7 years ago, Vicky Haig, and then there was a number of women from around the country who came on different evenings to talk about their own horrendous cases where they had a child taken for reasons as bizarre as that the mum represented a risk of future emotional harm to the child. I mean, this is all new to me at the time. I couldn't believe any of this was going on. And then I spoke off air to Christopher Booker, who's sadly not with us anymore, former Telegraph journalist, and others. And they said, no, this is going on. Sue Reid at the Daily Mail and others. And yeah. I was fairly flabbergasted. And then I followed the money at the time. It is £1 billion a year industry, isn't it? This forced adoption industry.
And that's what they say. The love of money is the root of all evil. And that is the thing behind it somehow. That is what's behind it all.
And it's because companies like Barnardo's, who work with other companies and work with local authorities, that placing children in foster care is incredibly lucrative. It's worth thousands of pounds per child per month, not just the fees paid to the foster families, but the fees paid to several groups of people, intermediaries like the adoption agencies themselves who find homes for these children. They're paid extraordinary sums of money. And it's been claimed over the years that this has led to corruption, that somehow, and I don't think it's ever been proven, but there are those who believe that maybe some barristers maybe, and even some judges maybe, are maybe somehow financially profiting from this. Didn't I read years ago, didn't you send me a link? I didn't believe you, I was dubious about it. Wasn't there a judge, a sitting family court judge, who had a share in, or who had shares in, an adoption agency? There was a certain judge, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was my judge. It was Judge Lee.
You're kidding me. Yeah, was it your judge?
He was since retired. He retired in 2021. But he was he removed my custody in 2017. And what I didn't know until after then, when I began to look into it, or others did, and then I found out through that, was that he used to be director of an adoption agency in Nottingham called Faith in Families. And, well, it's the opposite really, isn't it? Because you snatch the children off good families and give them to the adoption agency. And it used to be called, before that, it used to be called the Catholic Children's Society. And he was actually a director there from, I think it was 2009 to 2012. So he was sitting, it was during the time he's been sitting as a family court judge since early 2000s. So he's obviously got, he's got a real interest in removing children from parents who they shouldn't be removing them off.
Yeah.
And giving them to the adoption agency.
And if you're earning money from it and you're sitting in judgment of people, you would ordinarily, you would be asked to recuse yourself. You would be told, well, you're not suitable to preside over these hearings, over this hearing, because you've a vested interest yourself in children being taken into care. And I'm on forced-adoption.com. I recommend people check this website out. Also go to Samantha's website, Samantha Baldwin, samanthabaldwin.co.uk. But Ian Josephs has done a brilliant job of going over the finances of just how much money this is worth to adoption agencies, to local authorities, and to the families who, to be fair, many of them who are probably decent people, who think they're doing a good thing and might not have any clue that the parents, or sorry, that the children have been wrongfully taken from their parents. You're listening to Samantha Baldwin. Her latest book is Pretended Justice. I can't recommend it highly enough. Do check it out immediately. And just to repeat something Sam said a short time ago, she said, if you or anybody you know suspects that their partner or their ex-partner may be sexually abusing their child or their children, you're better off leaving the country at the speed of light than trusting the police and trusting the court system in the UK, because as Sam said, 9 out of 10 times when the accused parent, who might be guilty, who might not be, but let's say they are guilty, when that parent says, well, this is parental alienation, I didn't do that, my ex hates me and has told the children to say it, 9 out of 10 times, this is successful as a defence, which I still cannot get my head around. I mean, that is, if anything warrants an inquiry, It's that statistic alone, Sam.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there was a report a few years ago, they called it the harm report, and that was all kinds of domestic abuse, varying from partner abuse up until child abuse, but nothing has happened. Loads of people would have submitted their stories, their horror stories, but still we don't see anything changing.
But this is because we're not allowed to report on it.
Yeah, well, actually, there's some movement in that. And a reporter called Hannah Summers, and then there's Louise Tickle as well. They've been reporting on some cases. But in my opinion, I think the judiciary will be very selective about which cases they'll allow them to report on. I cannot imagine in a million years that they would allow somebody in to report on a case similar to mine.
And I understood when I first started asking questions about why is it that the press can't be present to record what's happening. I said, look, we understand you want to do as much as you can to protect the identities of the children. We get that. But we're grown-up journalists. We can report on a story, and we can do it in such a way that it doesn't identify the people. You know, you can change locations and use pseudonyms for the participants in the case. It's farcical for me when they say it's all about protecting people. I'm like, well, no, it's protecting what you're doing as opposed to protecting the children. Because if you did allow real journalists in there, this would change overnight, I reckon. You know, I don't know how many real journalists we have in the UK, but if you could get in there and report on this without using names and just put it out there that this is going on, you know, it might make some difference, Sam. How,
absolutely, Richard.
When we met, the lads were either 7 and 3 or 8 and 4. They're a good bit older.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were 7 and 4 at that particular time. So now they are. My eldest son will be 17 in August, and my youngest son is 13.
When was the last time you spoke to them?
The last time I spoke to them was when I last saw them, which was the 20th of December, 2017, 6.5 years ago.
And at the time I said something a bit stupid to you. I didn't mean to be stupid. It was a bit not well thought out. I said something about, I might have been a bit jolly about it. I had a brain, it was one of those brain farts that you have sometimes, Sam. I said, I said, you know, the day will come when all of these children turn 17, 18 and, you know, they'll be able to make their own decisions. And it was a stupid thing to say at the wrong time. And it's still stupid. But here we are now when your oldest is, you know, because that was no consolation to you 7.5 years ago. But your oldest is 17. Do you think it might be the case that in the very near future he might come looking for his mum?
Yeah, well, he's actually free from the both officially free from the court when they're 18. Because unfortunately, what many don't realise is that when they can get involved in these cases, high court judges can, create the court orders in such a way that they can stop even a 16-year-old, a 17-year-old. So yeah, the 18 is when they're officially free. We do have indirect contact, very infrequent indirect contact. Pre-recorded videos. Obviously, I don't want to divulge what they say because I don't want to, you know, risk anything there. But, you know, it's ridiculous that I'm saying at least, like, I'm grateful to the judge for this horrific thing. But, you know, at least it has kept the bond and I can tell them what I want to tell them, you know, albeit I can't really tell them what I want to tell them because they're being surveilled, obviously. But
what's their demeanour like, Sam? So obviously you can't discuss anything they said in the pre-recorded videos, but what would their demeanour be like? How did they come across? Were they happy? Were they happy to be sending you a message? Were they optimistic about sending you a message?
Well, it's varied, but I just think they're amazing boys and they're doing so well, and consistently they've created videos for the mum and they've told me that they love me and, you know, and they pour their heart and soul into it and, you know, tell me what they've been up to, bless them, you know.
Are they hard to watch?
It's always like really a mixture, because I'm always relieved when I watch them, and then, but like driving over there is like such, it's so stressful because it's such a mix of emotions, you know, not being able to see them, but yet seeing them on a screen, and it's heartbreaking. But at the same time, it's always a relief as well when I have seen them.
You're listening to Samantha Baldwin. I think the most high profile case in family court history, I think, Sam went on the run with her two boys when she knew that a family court ruling was going to go against her and the boys. The boys had claimed that Sam's ex-husband, their father, had sexually abused them, but not just him. They claimed that the grandparents were involved and others were involved. Now, I have to say this, and I'm not here to endorse Sam. Her ex-husband, Sam, did maintain and has always maintained that he did nothing wrong and that he wasn't guilty of any of these charges. I did extend an invitation to him through an intermediary back in 2017 to come on and talk, and I was told that he wasn't interested in doing it, in case anybody's wondering. But that's his story. And he stands by the family court decision back in 2017. And as far as he's concerned, that's the end of it. Sam says different, of course. You're listening to Samantha Baldwin. And we're talking about over 100,000 children. And it's a growing thing in care in the UK at the moment. Those are amazing numbers. And then I found out, Sam, I think you were one of the first people to tell me this. As far as many local authorities are concerned, or it is the case that many local authorities very quickly lose track of these children once they're in the care system. So as many as, I don't want to get this wrong, it's very important. But didn't I read in, this was shortly before the COVID nonsense, but as many as 30,000 children, minors, who were taken from their parents for good reasons and bad reasons, it must be said, were unaccounted for, Sam.
I don't know the exact figures for those, Richard, but I believe so. And I only saw something either today or yesterday, certainly in the past few days, about what they call looked after children by the local authority, and a large sum of them children go missing as well. It's utterly appalling. You know, one can only assume where they end up. But yeah, there's so many children unaccounted for that go missing. There's something, I can't remember, but I remember hearing about the figures for Rochdale alone, which was mind-boggling, about children in care just completely unaccounted for, never to be seen again.
According to the press in this country, paedophile rings and satanic paedophile rings are a moral panic. That is what the press says. The UK press is unequivocal. It says this is fantasy stuff, that there isn't a shred of evidence of high-powered people, high-profiled people running networks of paedophile rings, some of which are satanic in nature. It's a moral panic, they say. It's garbage. Now, you believe differently, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And this is somebody who's had a normal upbringing. I never even heard about any of this stuff right up until when my son's disclosed. And how old was I then? I was about 36, 37. I'd gone through my life up until that point, never hearing about it. But it didn't take long to find out what it was called. And then, you see, now there's many survivors speaking out, and they're all saying, so throughout all, you know, corners of the globe, they're all saying the same thing. They're all giving the same disclosures that each corroborate another's. No, of course they won't all be telling the truth, but that's just the nature of it. But the vast majority of them will. And yeah, I'm inclined to believe the survivors of it. And I think people involved in it, you know, your guess is as good as mine as to who when you're talking about high up. I don't look into all of that, and how could we know anyway? But it's possible. Yeah, nothing would surprise me. It really wouldn't. The world is different than the one I knew. It's like I've woken up and nothing surprises me anymore. But I'm very careful that I will only, you know, I can only kind of talk about what disclosures my son's made, and I can't really, you know, speak for anybody else. I'm obviously cautious to do so.
Fair enough. The Mirror today, the tabloid, for listeners who maybe don't know what I mean when I say the Mirror is a UK tabloid newspaper. It's reporting that it believes it knows the identity of the assassin who murdered Jill Dando, the journalist. And my great pal, Jean Anne, has just reminded me that it is believed by some credible people that Jill Dando was murdered because she was onto paedophile rings. And that's right, a lot of people, a lot of clever people, who are not prone to making big statements that they can't back up, believed that Dando was onto networks of paedophile rings in London. And this is the reason she was murdered, Sam.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. I've not picked up any recent stories of it, but it makes sense. Yeah, and it has happened with others as well, hasn't it? Like when they were onto something, whether it be in the UK or America, you hear about it time and time again, whether they're exposing elites, even though they don't deserve to be called that, of course, but when they're exposing elites or whoever they're speaking about, they can often just be bumped off very easily because, you know, people don't want to be called out, do they? It's the very nature of ritual abuse. It's hidden, and they want to stay that way, obviously, and call people fantasists and everything. So if anybody credible starts talking out, they hate it.
I'm going to play a clip. It's a long time since I played this clip. It's the famous clip of Tim Fortescue. Remember him? He was back in the 1970s.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Back in the 1970s, he was the Conservative Party chief whip. So he worked for Edward Heath. And he told a BBC programme in 1995, "Your maths is better than mine, Sam." I'm not patronising you. Everybody's maths is better than mine. So I'm trying to think, 95, so nearly 30 years ago.
30 years, yeah.
Yeah, just about 30 years. So Fortescue told this to the BBC, and I want to play this because it's very important.
That sounds pretty.
He's talking, I hope you can hear this now. It's on the same channel as you, so maybe you won't be able to, but maybe you will. Folks, have a listen. This was Westminster Secret Service. It was a BBC documentary which aired in 1995. This guy was a very, very high-ranking politician. He was the Conservative Party chief whip. What does that mean exactly? Well, I'll tell you. What it means is it's his job to keep Conservative Party MPs in the 70s, to keep them in line, to make sure they vote the right way on various bills and amendments and whatnot. What he said to the BBC was staggering, and I know this to be true. After saying this to the national broadcaster, this bastard was never interviewed under caution. Have a listen.
Anyone with any sense who was in trouble would come to the whips and tell them the truth and say, "No, this, I'm in a jam. Can you help?" It might be debt, it might be scandal involving small boys, or any kind of scandal which a member seemed likely to be mixed up in. They'd come and ask if we could help. And if we could, we did. And we would do everything we can, because we would store up brownie points.
You could hear that, Sam, could you?
I could hear that, yeah. I've not heard that, but I have heard it before, yeah. Wow.
It's an amazing admission, isn't it? MPs would come
to me. It really is, yeah.
And even though they would tell us that they've done the most disgusting thing you can do, which is to abuse a boy, we would get them off because we would store up brownie points. And I was only making my way into radio when this went out on the BBC. I don't even remember seeing it. But the fact that nobody thought to go to Fortescue and ask him to attend a police station to explain exactly what he meant during that programme, it's about one of the most amazing pieces of audio in the BBC's archive. There he is, as bold as brass. Yeah, buggering boys, and yeah, we would get them off, Sam.
It's absolutely astounding, but unfortunately, you know, the more and more time that goes by, the more likely I'm just like, yeah, this is the state of the country, the world that we live in. The crimes are just covered up, and you know, and yeah, goodness knows how far up it goes, really.
I don't know if I have the right to ask you this. You don't have to answer it, but I'll ask you anyway. I don't want to get too personal, but outside of campaigning, because it's not just campaigning for the truth about what happened, about what you believe happened in your story, but it's also about campaigning for people who might go through this, or to educate people. Have you been able to have a life in the last 7.5 years? Now, obviously, you've had a life. You've got up, you've dressed yourself, you've gone about your daily business. But have you been able to find any kind of happiness or kind of stability at all, relationships and whatnot? Or has this been all-consuming for you?
Well, thankfully, I have good, you know, peace of mind. I am blessed with that. But so in terms of, you know, no, I don't feel elated or joyful, but I have got that peace of mind that enables me, that just keeps me going and fighting for my sons. But it's not like I'm going out having fun and doing fun stuff all the time. Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. It's changed my world.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that, because I don't have any right to say to you, you have to live too, because you'll come back and say, well, I do live. I live for the day that I'm reunited with the lads. And I can't answer that. So, but I'd like to think that you might be able to, you know, a weekend here and there, park it. You know, you'll have friends, obviously, you've got a great family, that you'd be able to kind of reboost yourself or revitalise yourself by taking some time away from it. But no, look, I get your answer. I can't imagine what I would do going through. I've never had a child. And not even knowing what it's like to be a parent, I still feel it in my stomach when I speak to you or occasionally somebody else has gone through it, thinking, how could I get up every day wondering what's going on? And you've had to do that for all these years. It must take amazing strength. Tell us about your faith, because I didn't get into this the last time we spoke. It's very important. I'm an agnostic, me, who's more open-minded now than I ever was, I think, because of some of the things that are happening. But your faith is massively important. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I used to be agnostic too, Richie, like for years and years and years. And then this was, when the boys disclosed, I realised that there is a devil, and conversely, that God exists. And it was just a gradual process until I became full born again Christian, probably roughly beginning of 2017. So approximately around the same, you know, just before I lost custody of the boys. And then I've grown and grown in faith since then. And I literally, you know, I am believing for a miracle. I'm believing for a miracle. And you know, I just think, what kind of Christian would I be if I didn't? You know, I do have faith. I have faith in Jesus, but I also have faith that I'm going to get the boys back somehow. But yeah, the faith keeps me going. It's given me such peace, you know, such peace that I've never had before, in spite of what is going on. And it doesn't make any sense, but it helps me enormously.
Could you?
I don't know where I'd be without my faith.
Could you ever forgive your ex-husband?
Well,
I'm not trying to trap you now.
This will answer your question. But one of the when I first became Christian, I watched a lot of Derek Prince videos, and some of you viewers, if they're Christian, if they're into kind of the charismatic Pentecostal type Christianity. Derek Prince was, you know, I watch a lot of his videos. He died many years ago, but it's something resonated when he said, forgiveness is a decision and not an emotion. And I thought, I can do this.
It's tough stuff. I wasn't trying to trap you by asking you that question either.
No, not at all. No, and I realise some people would probably, like, years ago, I'd probably be like, how can you, how can you? And but you just, like, for me, I just, it's a constant, really, because you might say, oh, yeah, I forgive. But, and it doesn't obviously say what they've done is fine, because it's not. It's absolutely terrible and horrific. But it's releasing yourself from that burden of carrying all that pain and I've been through all of that. And when that's released and you just think, no, I hand this over to God. God is a judge. I hand it over to God. I'm not going to get in the way of this, and I'm not going to let it eat me up, you know. So that's my personal. I don't kind of tell people, oh, you need to forgive. It's such a personal thing anyway, but that really helped me hearing that. It just changed my mind on how I deal with things.
I want to ask you to tell me about Pretended Justice. Tell me what it's about. And just before you do that, this is about you, not about me, but I was violently abused by my father. Not sexually abused, but beaten constantly. And it was a very difficult thing. And he died a few years ago. I'd been estranged, or I hadn't seen him for 20 odd years. And even then, when I bumped into him in Waterford, I didn't have anything to say to him. And I've shone that same spotlight on myself, because I asked myself, you know, did I forgive him? And the answer is neither yes nor no. The answer was, for me, I just found a bit of understanding in it did happen. There wasn't very much I could do about it. And he's got to live with it, and I just don't care. So it wasn't forgiveness, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't carry any hatred or any bitterness or any of that. I left it all behind me. So that's why I asked about forgiveness, because I'm interested in it. What happened to you is far worse, and what he did, or what you allege he did to the lads, far worse than I ever went through. Samantha Baldwin is our guest. Why did you write Pretended Justice? What's it about, and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Well, it's the sequel to my first book, Everything's Going to Be Okay. They're both written in the style of novels, so the fiction, but the central character, Amanda, is very similar to, it's a very similar to what I've been through. I can identify a lot with the stories. And it was, they weren't easy to write. They were very difficult in parts to write. You know, I was bringing up all kinds of emotion and dragging up things I didn't want to put myself through. But I felt I really needed to get these books written and published. And it's been a long time in the making, actually, from the start when I first got the idea up until having it published, because certain legal applications took over at one point. But yeah, it's the pretend. So the first book is Amanda's story, right, starts from 2003 when she met her husband, where she ended up marrying him and their relationship, and then had two children, two boys, and then talks about the horror when they started to disclose and she got them taken off her by the family court. That's all the first book. And the second book takes off from where the first book ended, which in that timeline was 7 years ago, and it talks about the abomination that is the family court and the state bodies that surround it, and it really does go into the exposure of the system in the form of a novel.
Where can people get it? Where would you prefer they got it?
Well, if you're in the UK, for sure, if you can get it from my website, which is samanthabaldwin.co.uk, it's available paperback and also ebook. But if you're abroad, you're very welcome to get it from the website, but the postage is more expensive. So in that case, it's for that reason, I also put it onto Amazon as well, so that people can access it from their own Amazons worldwide. So really, it's up to the viewer if they're interested. But yeah, it does help me if you're in the UK. It's very much appreciated if you can buy it directly from my website.
I've been reading it online. Have you had any help with it, or did somebody edit it, or have you just written it and put it out?
Well, with the first book, you see, I met this lady who was a godsend in all of this, Trina Scully. She's an Irish lady. And And she helped me enormously with the first book and basically taught me how to write and coached me all the way through it and edited it. So this time I did more of the writing myself and then Trina just edited it. But yeah, I did basically write it myself and then had Trina's amazing editing.
It's very, very good. It's very easy to read, which is the reason I asked the question. Yeah, pretended justice. Let me read a couple of comments out to you. You won't be surprised. I've had dozens and dozens of comments coming in from people. They're all complimentary. Amazing, brave woman, says Cookie. Horrible story. Tragic, but great to hear. Sam. Nelly says, I'm sickened to my core hearing Sam speak about her experiences. A number of people are saying the same thing. How could it possibly happen in the UK in the 21st century? How could you have such secrecy, such bizarre decisions taken by family court judges, the lack of press coverage because the press are banned, so many of these. Julie says it's a horror story. Why isn't anyone at all trying to help her? I wasn't going to ask you this because it's obvious, but you went the politician route, didn't you, back in the day? You asked people for help and they were...
Yeah, I've done everything, Richie, to be honest. Everything that you can think of. But no, it just doesn't. It's just... It's almost like the family court are untouchable.
And you said just before we wrap for today, you said that there is a little bit of movement there. And I think this is coming from journalists, isn't it? Journalists who write for the national press have been pushing at this door, trying to force it open for years to get access, because it really is untenable in a so-called democracy that people could be... Such hugely important cases could be going on and in complete secrecy with no chance for a journalist to expose any wrongdoing or anything. So how optimistic are you about that? About, you know, the fact that journalists are banging on the door saying, look, enough is enough now. We want to be present to hear some of these cases.
Yeah, I think it's good. I don't think it's immediately going to solve everything, because I just have a feeling that the family court won't allow them in on the more kind of serious cases like mine. But I think, yeah, it is a good thing. And maybe I am being a bit kind of, you know, cautious about my view on that. But yeah, it will help. But I just think there needs to be more. And somehow I think, you know, my particular thing is helping the family court for the children and particularly for abuse survivors of any kind, whatever kind of child abuse it is, because it's all horrendous. But and how and what can change, what legislation can change to help those children be believed and for the innocent parents not to be vilified. And I don't know how yet, but it would involve some, you know, about children's voices being held with more importance somehow. And I do advocate for the use of polygraph testing in there as well, which at the moment they don't have in, unless both parents agreed, which, let's face it, if one parent's a liar, they're not going to be in agreement to that. But that's the only thing I can think of that will help this particular situation.
Can I just before we do say goodbye today, can I take issue with the polygraph thing? And what I mean by take issue with it, I know your tests were slam dunk, I know they were. But what about those who say that they're not perfect and that, you know, in the States in particular, polygraphs were taken against people who ended up going to prison, maybe not on the evidence from the polygraph test, but that the polygraph test went against them. It suggested they were telling lies. And then we later found out they were exonerated because evidence turned up. What do you say to those who say that they're not perfect yet, polygraph tests, and people who are innocent can fail them? What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's not good, but nothing is ever going to be 100% fallible. But I would say that it's a heck of a lot better than the current 49%, 51% balancing tip of the family court, which means that we can all end up with horrific false findings against us based on nothing. So that's like a comparison that I would make.
It's a weird thing, kind of knowing you as I do. I don't know you that well, but we speak occasionally on social media and you've been on with me over the years. It's a weird one, isn't it? Because I believe you're telling the truth as far as you understand it, which means a lot to me. I won't speak to anybody who I believe is lying, or I will, and, you know, I'll do my best to try and go after them. So I find myself hoping that you are right in your understanding of what happened over the years, but also it's an awful place to be, isn't it, hoping that you're right, because the things that were alleged by the boys and claimed by the boys are just unspeakable. I mean, I wouldn't dare speak about them this evening on the programme, the actual allegations, because they are, they're just too bloody awful. But I do think you're remarkable, and your mum and your sister, I'll never forget that seven or so years ago, knowing that it was you that had gone through all of that, absconding and sitting there listening to you. And I thought I was going to meet a mad woman, to be honest. I mean, I genuinely did, you know. And what a story it is. And just to echo what listeners are saying to me today, that, you know, you're amazing. I mean, they're saying it here. Paula, God bless. Sam, Richie, the injustice of her story is palpable. The Bible tells us this system is Satan's, and it's great that Sam has found faith. All the best to her, and praise God, from Paula. That's a really lovely message.
Lovely.
Cecile, same again, amazing, an incarnation of courage and faith Sam is, and an inspiration. So there's so many of these, and yeah, it's nice on the one hand to speak to you again after such a long time, but also I'd love to be speaking to you in 6, 12 or 18 months, and maybe your eldest is sitting in the room, maybe. That'd be something else, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I do believe something's going to happen. I do. But yeah, next time I'm on the show, you know, I'm sure it will be good news then.
Well, look, congratulations on writing Pretended Justice. I'll put the links on the podcast notes after the live show, as I always do. It's a great achievement. And I suppose no point in me saying keep going or keep battling, because it'd be a stupid thing to say, because it's what you've been doing nonstop for over 7 years. So thanks for your company again today, Sam. And Godspeed to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Richie.
That was Samantha Baldwin live on Wednesday's Richie Allen radio show. Sam is the author of Pretended Justice. The sequel to Everything Is Going to Be Okay. If you put Sam's name in an internet search engine, and then if you click news, you'll find all of the stories back in 2017, when she absconded with her sons, when they were eventually discovered, the case after that, and everything that's been going on since then. It is 18 minutes to the top of the hour. I'll take a very quick break. When I come back, I'll read some of your comments. There are many of them to read, so there are. In the meantime, music from Neil Young. This is Harvest Moon. Music from Neil Young, Harvest Moon, on the Richie Allen Show. 13 and a half minutes to the top of the air. Wednesday's programme. It's really good to be back. Thanks for all of your messages. Gail read Sam's first book and will be getting the second. Best wishes and love to Sam, says Gail. Lots of messages like that. Thank you for them. Let me just go to, just to give you an idea of the money around forced adoption. The website I mentioned during the conversation with Sam, Sam's website is samanthabaldwin.co.uk. Ian Josephs is a British man living in France. He's an Oxford graduate. He's an expert in law. I don't think he's ever acted for anybody. I don't think he's worked as a solicitor, but he has a law degree. And he has helped many women get out of the UK when they faced losing their children through the family courts. And the latest information around money and how lucrative taking children into care happens to be, the latest information is 2020 to 2021. Have a listen to this. He writes on his website, forced-adoption.com or forced-adoption. It's forced-adoption.com, yeah. Fostering and adoption agencies make millions of pounds in profits. Special schools, and special is in inverted commas, like ones for children who run away from care or who are difficult, these schools charge local authorities £3,000 to £4,000 per week per child, which is more than three times the fees required to enter Eton. £3,000 to £4,000 a week. And then he says the consortium of voluntary adoption agencies, the interagency fee levels and guidance from 2020 to 2021 are as follows. For a child to be placed with a foster family, a single child, that is worth £32,000 to the agency. Are you hearing this? So the agency will be given £32,000 for finding a foster family for the child. For two kids, it rises to £51,700. For three, £70,331. And then it goes up and up and up and up and up. And these are the inter-agencies. It's staggering, really. You know, so a child becomes a commodity or a product. And in such a system, you can see how easily it can happen where they seek out more and more exotic reasons or bizarre reasons, as we said in the conversation with Sam, to justify removing a child from his or her mother or father's care and placing them in care because it's worth hundreds of millions of pounds a year to a variety of agencies. It's quite amazing, really. And it's going on all the time in this country. And many children who are taken into care and placed with foster families, they go missing. Thousands of them a year go missing and are unaccounted for. And that's something you don't have to believe. You can look it up yourself. You can check it out online. Again, Google those very simple terms. Children in care going missing and you'll see it is thousands. Thousands, yeah. Okay. Hi to Richard. Richie, what are your thoughts on the latest smoking bill, he says. I, for one, cannot see any way they can enforce this without digital ID. Richard, I'm going to have to look it up. I know of what you refer. I know that Sunak has a plan. It hasn't yet gone through the House of Commons, so it doesn't. So it hasn't. I don't believe it has. They want to raise the age where it's legal to buy cigarettes. They want to raise it by a year every year for the next 10 years or 15 years so that eventually nobody will ever be old enough to buy cigarettes. Have I butchered that? I think that's it. Let me just bring it up here. I don't know. I mean, I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I've never even held one. I find them detestable, to be honest with you. But I'm an old school, you know, live and let live guy, so long as it's not bothering me. If somebody wants to smoke in his or her own home, they should be allowed to. I mean, so long as you know all the information there is to know, you know. Let me just put in smoking ban UK and see what I get, because as usual, when I'm caught on the hop like that, I have half the story, don't I? And not the full story. Let me give it to you. The restrictions. Oh no, they have voted. They have backed. It has gone through the Commons. It'll have to go through the Lords now. Yes, MPs, according to the BBC, have voted to back the government's plans to create a smoke-free generation and reduce the number of smoking-related deaths. You see, it's just as well, Richard, that I looked it up because I had half the story. Yeah, so the restrictions will apply to the sale of cigarettes in the UK rather than the act of smoking itself, the physical act. So under the new law, each year, the legal age for cigarette sales, which is currently 18, will increase by 1 year, meaning that people born in or after 2009 will never be able to legally buy a cigarette. The law will not affect those who are already allowed to buy cigarettes. The government says it will introduce £100 on-the-spot fines for shops in England and in Wales which flout the law. So that's the gist of the story. It has passed the Commons. I missed it. I was on holiday. And I definitely avoided the news when I was away. I'm a bit agnostic about it. I don't like state encroachment on people's personal choices. Of course I don't. I also don't like the idea of people smoking around children. I grew up in a household where both parents smoked and it disgusted me. You know, there was a permanent fog of smoke, cigarette smoke, stale cigarette smoke in the living room. It can't have done me any good as a child. So I don't like it. That being said, I've got to acknowledge these days, you know, I live in Salford, obviously, the great city of Salford. And I often, when I'm walking the streets with the dogs, I do see people standing outside smoking, standing outside their own homes. So it seems that without being compelled to take the children into consideration, people are naturally doing it. They don't need to be forced to by big government. It seems that most people will step outside their own house to have a cigarette. I shouldn't say most people, because I don't know the exact statistics. But it seems a lot of people are stepping outside and having a cigarette. And in many cases, tenancy agreements contain clauses, don't they, where you can't smoke in the property. I mean, these days we own our own home, but we rented for years, and every single one of those rental agreements contained an undertaking on our behalf that nobody would smoke in the house, not us, not our guests. So I don't know where I stand on it. I think they're filthy things, and I think they're obviously very unhealthy for people. I mean, they must be. And if they are, you'd like to encourage people not to take it up. But I don't like, as I said, governments telling people what they should and shouldn't do. I wouldn't be in favour of this, you know. Good evening to Elizabeth. She says, Richie, they are now implementing in stores in the Netherlands face scans to check people's age in order to determine whether they should buy cigarettes. Wow. There's your AI, says Elizabeth. Thanks for that. Lloyd says, surely the smoking ban will increase the black market for cigarettes. Yes, Lloyd. 100%. On the conversation with Samantha, Jane has been in touch to say, it really is satanic, isn't it? Yes. Hi to Caroline, who says, didn't Tony Blair put quotas on putting children into care? Caroline, I can't say for sure whether he did or whether he didn't. I would imagine that would have been a difficult sell, to put a quota on how many children need to be taken away from their families. But I'm not contradicting you. You might very well be right. I'll have to check that out a little bit later on. Well, look, that's pretty much it for today's programme. It's brilliant to be back. Thank you for listening. As always, the programme is archived on iTunes, Spotify, Podomatic.com. It's where I upload it. Thank you to Samantha Baldwin for coming on to talk about her brand new book, which is entitled Pretended Justice. I recommend you pick up a copy right now. Thanks to Sam. We'll hear from her again in the future, no doubt. The Papers podcast will be online tomorrow by 7:30. A little bit later. I was killing myself. Crack of dawn. And I was killing myself. So 7:30, Monday to Friday. The Richie Allen Show is back now. And because you keep plaguing me about it, Sunday Morning Melodies will be back a week on Sunday, which I think is the 5th of May. Is it? It is. Yeah, a week on Sunday, the Melodies returns. There you are. Have a great rest of your Wednesday, and I hope you'll catch up with me tomorrow. Until then, it's bye from the BBG.